Today, the apartheid of science is breaking down. The theoretician adjusts parameters to experimental evidence. The experimentalist responds to the theory, and the technology reacts to both in creating his hardware, and the hardware itself services the experimentalist and the theoretician. Through this feedback system, scientific progress has been accelerated to a fantastic degree. The volume of scientific information has become a Niagara. And natural philosophy, which I'd remind you was the beginning of what we're talking about, has been swamped by experimental results. In terms of moral philosophy, the is and the ought rarely sit down together in the same room. We talk about the gulf between the two cultures. My noble friend, C.P. Snow's definition. We talk about the gulf between the two cultures and lament the fact that science and the humanities are barely on speaking terms. It is true that with the fragmentation of science into specialties and the proliferation of concepts and terms, cryptic terms, mystic terms almost, there is difficulty in communication. But it's also true that there's been more effort, Mr. Chancellor, there has been more effort to bridge that gulf on the side of scientists than of the humanities. The fundamental right of finding out has to be respected and has to be safeguarded. Nor can we, like the old cartographers, write of unknown areas, here be dragons, and delimit the forbidden territories. The medieval church tried it, but we know that there were candles in the dark, even in the dark ages. Discoveries were being made. The only constraint was in their disclosure, not in their finding out, but in their disclosure. Now, the sublime Leonardo was not the stuff that martyrs are made of. He was not going to incur the wrath of the Inquisition, nor invite the rack, nor, like his exact contemporary Savonarola, the burning faggots. Nevertheless, I'm out to pause here for a commercial and say I've just written a book on Leonardo. Nevertheless, and I'm going to bore you with it whether you like it or not. Nevertheless, he pursued his researches, and in his right to left mirror handwriting, he wrote, Il solo no si muove. The sun does not move. He wrote that a century and a half before Galileo. This heresy dethroned man from the center of the universe and challenged his egocentricity as God's special creation. Leonardo, from his direct observation of the marine shells of inland Tuscany, disputed the story of the flood, maintaining that they showed that the seas had once covered the area and it was not a rain deluge, it was the oceans. He studied the nature of the rocks and rebutted the idea of six-day creation. He avoided the consequences by pretending to be the devil's advocate. And that was all right, provided the devil didn't seem to win the argument. And he would write, the adversary says, when he meant Plato, or Aristotle, or Galen, or even the Old Testament. And any sanctified authority of the church. When citing some forbidden experiment, he would write as an injunction to the anonymous you will do so-and-so, when it was something which he intended to do, in fact, had already done. He carried out the section of 37 human cadavers against the prevailing church ban. The determined investor, all I'm trying to say, using my Leonardo as the example, the determined investigators will defy any restriction. The sanction in these days of vastly expensive equipment would be to withhold funds so that the impossible would take just a little longer. And sometimes, talking to my scientific friends, I wish they didn't reach into the pocketbook so often and try to think out what they might do without it. It might, in fact, encourage a lot of quite novel thinking, which you can get out of a Sears Roebuck catalog. The sanction there is to withhold funds. But I repeat, the impossible would in that case just take a little longer, while ingenuity substituted for hardware. Curiosity would and will prevail. Therefore, any suggestions of a moratorium in science are nonsensical, they're untenable. And then the kinds of knowledge we call scientific are extremely diverse. They extend from nuclear particles to the mental processes, from the birth and the death of stars to the migration of birds, from the sea bottom to the expanding universe, from the ultra-microscopic viruses to earthquake convulsions, and from the structure of crystals to the process of aging. They deal with the macrocosmos and they deal with the microcosmos. They deal with the secrets of matter, and they deal with the secrets of life. Such innumerable and endlessly diverse subjects cannot be brought under any formula and cannot be constrained by any restriction, not even a ratio. What people really mean when they talk about a moratorium of science is putting brakes on the applications of science. Not the findings out, but the use, misuse, or the abuse of what is found out. They are talking, in fact, about constraints on technology. And this is where the is and the ought have to be reconciled. The late Sir Richard Gregory, editor of Nature, one of the most socially minded scientists I've ever known, used to defend vigorously the innocence of science. He used to point out that on the same page of a chemical reference book, one would find juxtaposed chloroform and mustard gas. The one was regarded as eminently beneficial to humanity, and the other as a devilish weapon of war. The chemist first made chloroform in 1831 as a laboratory curiosity. 16 years later, a medical practitioner, medical technology, if you want to put it crudely, a medical practitioner, James Y. Simpson, after self-experimentation, used it as an anesthetic. The discoverer of mustard gas was merely studying and isolating the interesting properties of that time-old condiment, mustard. He found out the fraction that made it useful as a poultice. This blistering factor was to be sublimated, save the mark, sublimated into the vesicant, agent Q, which in minute quantities will burn and blind, and if inhaled as an aerosol, will kill. As Gregory used to say, it was the others who took the findings of science and turned them into destruction. And that was substantially true, except that even in previous war times, scientists themselves were patriotically prevailed to become the technologists of new weapons. Nevertheless, Gregory could fairly acquit pure or academic science of premeditated evil. He could maintain that between the wars. And that was true until the atom bomb. In that event, it was not the military, nor the politicians, nor the merchants of death who took existing scientific knowledge and perverted it. Scientists were responsible for taking the fundamental discovery of uranium fission by outer hand and turning it into a cataclysmic weapon. The recognition of the chain reaction to which the discovery lent itself suggested possibilities of an explosion orders of magnitude greater than anything possible from chemical reactions. Einstein had propounded in 1905 the equation E equals mc squared, energy equals the mass multiplied by the square of the speed of light, which meant that matter can be converted into energy. It was Einstein, the lifelong pacifist, with Edward Teller, Eugene Wigner, and Leo Szilard, who went in July 1939, within 9 months of Hahn's discovery, and persuaded him to write to President Roosevelt, drawing his attention to the fact, quote, "This new phenomenon will lead to the construction of bombs, extremely powerful bombs." Years later, appalled by the prospects which this proposal had produced, and before the bomb itself had gone off, Einstein was to try and persuade Roosevelt not to use the bomb, then in production. Incidentally, Roosevelt never got his message. And later still, after the horrors of Hiroshima, he was to try to stop President Truman's H-bomb, of which he said, "If successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere and hence the annihilation of all life on Earth has been brought within the range of technical possibility. Every step appears as an unavoidable consequence of the preceding one." And he said, "In the end, there beckons more and more clearly general annihilation." Many, indeed most of the great scientists who have been involved in the proposals and in their fulfillment suffered the same moral revulsion. A sense of guilt was built into science, which had not been there before, and if I may say so, ladies and gentlemen, is still there. It led to the great pugwash movement, which one might call the ecumenical of science, bringing together scientists from all over the world, beginning with the nuclear physicists, burdened with the guilt of their own involvement in the bomb, bringing together many disciplines to consider their responsibilities to mankind. The pugwash movement, which I regard, and I think history will regard, as one of the most significant things of our time. Pugwash, Nova Scotia, was the birthplace of Cyrus Eaton, the layman who first called the conference and brought together West and East scientists whom the politics of the Cold War had divided. Now, just as in that spectrum which exists from pure science through technology to techniques, it is difficult to draw the lines of separation. So it is invidious to distribute blame if and when there is cause for blame. Distribute the blame between the makers possible and the makers to happen. I doubt, however, whether Gregory's immaculacy of science could be sustained by anyone today. Ivory Tower scientists claiming sanctuary for their discoveries are rare today. And while there are many who shudder away from the public debate, many more recognize and accept the social and the moral responsibilities of science. With the plenitude of new discoveries and the rapidity and the scale of their application, scientific individuals and societies feel as helpless as the rest of us in trying to curb the misapplication of these discoveries. The change in time calibration, the drastic reduction of the lag between the conception of scientific discovery and the technical application of that discovery is the main complication. Today, there is no one to carry the red flag in the front of the motor car. The feasibility study of a new development does not include the true evaluation of the social consequences or the possible erosion of human rights. We get hypnotized by gadgets or are dazzled by the spectacular achievements before we even realize the encroachments which they are making upon those rights. Now take the effects of miniaturization. One recalls that beyond the contraction which was necessary to put radar into aircraft, an even more compulsive factor in miniaturization was the proximity fuse, the device which made a bomb or a shell home on a target, turning a near miss into a kill. The radar fuse, which was developed during the war and was very, very important, in fact decisive, in the Battle of the Bulge, the radar fuse which was developed had to stand 20,000 times the force of gravity when fired from a gun. That fuse was a highly complicated radio set. To get results, the thermionic valve had to be reduced to the size of a vitamin capsule. It still had to be made of toughened glass with filaments, grids, etc., and evacuated. The contact fuse in the nose of the shell had to include detectors, amplifiers, batteries, antennae, and firing switches, all in midget scale in the nose of one shell. And all of great durability and efficiency. It provided, the development of this provided the research and development experience which was embodied in post-war television, the cinema, and industry. After the war, we had transistors replacing the thermionic valves by cold components, that's to say the transistor, now no bigger than a pinhead and requiring minimal power. With the refinement of printed circuits and solid circuits, the piece of furniture, which had been the living room receiver before the war, became the pocket transistor after the war. It is necessary to grasp the significance of this miniaturization because it has more relevance to your human rights than you think. It is making possible reprehensible inroads on human rights and human privacy. Size is important. Ancient man could dig a moat against the mammoth, but modern man is still vulnerable to the virus.